So, welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod.
Episode 46. Right, we're back. We've got fancy new kit.
Oh, we've got some new kit that I haven't learned completely how to use because it's like a big control panel in front of me, but it can do things like this.
We promise we won't use it.
We obviously won't do that too much.
But hopefully, maybe, people can tell a slight sound difference.
Yeah, particularly if I do this.
Because they'll see that my voice can change. All right, I'll stop. I will. I promise I'll stop.
I'm going to have to take it off him. actually, we might have to use that because you're a little bit under the weather.
Yes, I've been fighting this bloody flu bug for 3 weeks and I'm still a bit nasally, but I'm coming out the other end and I must be because I've just played an hour of tennis.
Should be fine.
Forced me onto the tennis court to play a doubles match this morning.
Yeah, forced.
Forced me.
So, to be fair, if you cough lots, you're just making editing work for yourself.
That's true. So, so that's about all the catch-up I've got is that I've been ill. Bug-ridden for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
We bought a bit of fancy kit just to try and elevate the... just have a bit of fun, really.
Yeah, so. Elevate it, really. You just want to play around with a cool sound.
Yeah, you probably, when you listen to episode 46, you probably won't hear any difference to 45, but we'll have had fun playing with it.
And it does look very cool.
I think I've got quite a bit to learn on, actually, because it's got a lot of buttons.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But we are back, and this was an episode that I've been wanting to do for a while, and we've ended up having to change it slightly. And it came about by you mentioning that starlings, I'm going to ruin, obviously, a bit spoiler alert, but starlings are on the IUCN red list for sort of vulnerable animals. And I thought, oh, that's really surprising because you see a lot of them, especially in your garden.
Are you actually spoiling my part?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it made me want to do an episode on animals that are surprisingly in the red list, you know, ones that you see day to day and you think, I wouldn't expect that to be threatened or struggling, but they are actually.
And we're talking UK-based, obviously, so.
But then it turned out, aside from quite a few birds, when we decided to divvy up the different sort of groups of animals, most of them aren't that surprising.
Particularly when you got into the mammals and
reptiles
stuff
like
that,
as well. It's just like, oh.
And actually, we have covered some of them in previous episodes.
Yeah, so it ended up, I realised that actually a lot of the struggling animals aren't necessarily a surprise, but still want to do something a little bit around the red list and give you an excuse to talk about some surprising birds.
Yeah.
So instead, we're doing an episode all about some of the UK species that are on the red list, some surprising, some perhaps not. Talk a little bit about what the red list is. And then to make sure it's not too doom and gloom, we've got a little bit of good news around, you know, some maybe animals that are doing better now, some good conservation stories, and just sort of a little bit of a discussion about some of the animals that, you know, are struggling and sit on the red list.
Yeah.
So that is the episode.
Okay, well, do you want to define, I mean, obviously there's the international red list, isn't it? So do you want to define that?
Yeah, so it's the typical one that you see is the IUCN red list, which is the International Union for Conservation of Nature red list. And it's essentially a list of threatened species, and it's evolved to become sort of the world's most comprehensive information on global extinction risk of animals. It also covers things like fungi and plant species. It was established back in 1964. And just as a bit of a, because I say we're very much focusing on the UK, that's a little like you there, the UK, in this episode, to give a bit of a global, snapshot. There's currently 166,000 species on the IUCN red list, with more than 46,000 species threatened with extinction. And that includes 44% of reef-building corals, 41% of amphibians, 38% of trees, 37% of sharks and rays, 26% of mammals, 12% of birds, and 26% of freshwater fish. So that's sort of the percentages of the groups. And just to give a bit of, I guess, context around how it's determined, like what puts an animal on this list, is they have 9 categories that an animal can sit in or a species can sit in. And that is data deficient, which essentially means it hasn't been analysed properly yet. Least concern, near threatened, vulnerable, endangered, critically endangered, extinct in the wild, and then just extinct. And to determine where a species sits, the assessment is essentially run through a variety of sort of criteria, including population reduction.
Is
the population obviously decreasing? The geographical range of that population, is it restricted? The actual size and decline, essentially the rate of decline, as well as running a statistical extinction probability analysis. And so when experts are looking and sort of analysing a species, they'll take into consideration all of these criteria, and then depending on the results, will decide if they're threatened, vulnerable, critically endangered, for example. And yeah, essentially the IUCN Red List is our global go-to list of seeing, you know, is an animal at risk? How are they doing? Is their population improving? They can, you know, if conservation is going well, species will move about, and you might see headlines like reptile species has moves from vulnerable to least concern, and you're like, okay, great, they're doing well, or vice versa, things can go really badly and they start moving down through the categories. But it's a really good way of keeping track of how a population of a species is sort of faring.
Yeah, and it's turned into a huge organisation, actually. It's an independent worldwide organisation. It consists of 1,400 member organisations, 15,000 nature experts in over 160 countries, and it has become the global authority of the status of the natural world. So it is a hugely respected organisation, and the data that it provides is absolutely critical across the world, and it is used across the world to determine, obviously, populations, how climate change, all of those things that we've talked about so many times, and the impact it's having on all of the species in the world. And it's an incredible
Their website's brilliant
It is amazing.
But you'll see it referred to everywhere. Scientific papers refer to it. If you go onto like the Wildlife Trust website, and they obviously have lots of profiles for animals that you can see, they'll always have under the conservation status where it sits on the IUCN Red List. It is sort of the go-to, how's the animal doing? Yeah. Are they threatened? But their website's a really good resource for sort of, I don't know, just looking up and seeing the state of nature.
Yeah, and it's interesting because obviously we're going to talk UK-based species today, but the UK Red List, for example, I'm doing birds, has now been authorised and recognised at IUCN level. So all of the processes involved in gathering that data and the criteria that is essential in determining that correct data has been recognised by IUCN, and the processes are all the same. And the same with the mammals red list as well, that's been authorised by IUCN. So it's a common process, and it's recognised by that organisation.
Tried and tested, isn't it? So it's a useful thing to adapt to your own individual list as well.
Yeah, definitely. So the way we've split it today is that I'm doing birds and British birds and mammals, Matt's doing invertebrates and fish, and then we've divided amphibians and reptiles up.
Yeah,
I'm doing amphibians, you're doing reptiles. There's a bit of a overlap of things that we've talked about in the past of threatened species, so we probably won't be spending too much time on those.
No, it's more of I wanted to get in some of the surprising species, mainly on the bird side, but it's just almost like a whistle-stop tour of some of our red-listed animals, and let's say some good news thrown in as well.
Yeah.
Reptiles and amphibians was tricky because we don't have that many reptile and amphibian species, and if any of them are on the red list, it's not that surprising.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I've got a few in the mammals that people think, I'm not surprised by that. So, but we're gonna highlight them.
Yeah,
anyway,
we'll put a bit of information around it.
So, shall I kick off on?
Yeah, kick birds. Off on a bird, and we'll alternate and
I know
mix
we've
it up.
I know we've described what the red list is, but why is a bird placed on the red list? There's a little bit of criteria that has to determine when a species, not just birds, go on the red list. So there are four criteria. They're threatened with global extinction. They've undergone a severe historical population decline in the UK since 1800. Breeding numbers in the UK have fallen by at least half in the last 25 years or longer. Or their breeding range in the UK has had a severe contraction of at least 50% in the last 25 years. And British birds haven't fared very well, actually, or UK birds haven't fared very well, because in 1996, when the UK Red List was first published, we only had 36 species of native birds on that red list. And we now have, it's just recently grown from 67 to 70. So we now have 70 birds.
Yeah, that's quite a big jump, isn't it? Not a lot of time.
Which is a little bit concerning, obviously. In fact, it's very concerning. And I'm going to start off on starlings, which you've already alluded to.
Yeah, sorry.
And the reason I'm starting off on starlings is because I think it's a little bit misunderstood. We see, particularly in wintertime, We see all the films on
big murmurations
Winter Watch, and we see these massive murmurations of starlings, and they can be flocks of hundreds of thousands, not just a few thousand, hundreds of thousands in one go. So we have this perception that, crikey, there's a lot of starlings about. And that's actually a false thing, you know, to think of, because starling breeding numbers have fallen by 70% in the last 25 years, 83% since 1969. You're not going to be surprised by the decline as changes in habitat.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken about a lot of birds before.
Agricultural intensification, a reduction in survival rates of juvenile birds, which is also determined by the changes in agricultural use, particularly because starlings feed very much on leather jackets and crane fly larvae that they find at the surface of grassland.
Yeah.
And you'll see often, I get them here, starlings on the grass here at certain times of the year pulling crane fly larvae out of the grass. And obviously with the reduction of grassland because of intense agriculture, that has reduced.
Probably pesticides usage.
Pesticides,
as well.
Definitely. And there are little snippets of things that make you realise that, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, there were a lot of starlings about, because there are little things like there were once so many starlings in London that they could stop Big Ben by perching on it.
Oh, blimey.
So they would perch on the hands of Big Ben, and in such big numbers that they would stop the clock.
That's hilarious.
Which is a great little bit of trivia that I found. But the stark fact is that we've got half as many starlings in Britain as there were in the mid-90s. What I couldn't find out, I mean, conservation-wise, because I think what we'll do is we'll highlight each species and then maybe just at the same time do whatever conservation. The only conservation that is trying to be done to alleviate that is to try and maintain grass field margins and unfertilised grassland for foraging for starlings, because that's the biggest reason.
Yeah.
That loss of that habitat has had a huge effect. And also roosting spots as well. They roost primarily in hedges, and of course we've lost a lot of hedgerows.
Yeah, actually we've got a whole episode on hedges, if you want to go back and listen. It's very important for a lot of birds and other species.
So again, it's trying to educate farm owners and landowners to try and provide and leave that or regenerate grassland on the perimeters of their land, which will help starlings. It's quite funny because there is a perception of starlings that they're sort of vermin and they're noisy.
I think it's because they're big rabbles, isn't it?
And I sometimes think that we've talked about this before, about things like, you know, people have got this dim view of adder conservation, for example, because the adder's just a nasty animal. There is a little bit of a perception that starlings are vermin, and actually they're incredibly smart, stunningly beautiful, and really important, like all species, incredibly important for biodiversity and the ecosystem. So the only conservation that's being done is trying to educate landowners for beneficial land management for starlings. But the stark fact is that across Europe, 40 million starlings have disappeared in the last 30 years.
Yeah, that is concerning.
So when you see those, you know, you go and see those massive murmurations of starlings and think that they're, you know, that they're population is absolutely escalating, it's couldn't be any further from the truth. So
just a really quick little fact that I've just googled while you're talking there, because we mentioned starlings being sort of considered a bit of a pest, I just thought I'd find out what the collective noun is for a starling, of a group of starlings. Obviously in their big murmurations it's a murmuration, but a smaller group, the one that I like is a chattering.
However,
some not very nice ones, apparently they're commonly called a filth of starlings,
really?
A scourge or a vulgarity.
Yeah, so there definitely is that perception that they are vermin and they are a pest and
one of the
annoying.
The two that come up most frequently are chattering and a murmuration. And chattering's lovely, but filth apparently is a common one, and that's really harsh.
Well, also, it is harsh because they're incredibly, like a lot of birds, they're incredibly intelligent.
And beautiful.
And stunningly beautiful, but they've got this incredible way of mimicking. They're fantastic mimickers, not only of human sounds. They're great at mimicking alarms and house alarms and things like that. But they will do things like, when they're in flocks, if they see a bird of prey, particularly sparrowhawks, which sparrowhawks are a favourite predator for starlings, they will mimic the sound of a sparrowhawk to alert the flock to fly. So
that's
they
cool,
have learned
it?
How to mimic the noise of a sparrowhawk to say, shit, get out of here, yeah. You know, everyone go. They're such cool birds. I love them.
Yeah, I love
them. They
come
in and absolutely decimate the fat balls in my garden in huge numbers.
Yeah, you've got half of West Sussex population in your garden.
But I absolutely love them. They're hilarious to watch and they're stunningly beautiful birds. If you've ever seen the iridescent plumage of a starling in the sunshine, it's purples and greens and golds.
And speckled.
They're absolutely beautiful. I love them. And, you know, more needs to be done to be, you know, to create awareness that they are really struggling. And it would be a very sad day
if we lost our starlings.
Because, you know, you're all very happy to go and stand on a pier and watch
murmurations
and wonder at that nature in front of you. So, we have to protect the starlings. Yeah. So that's my first one.
Right. Well, I was going to hop in with butterflies. And so I have got some example sort of specific species, but I haven't picked one out in particular because a news article came out, and I think it was 2020, that realised that or published the news that now half of British butterfly species are on the red list. So a lot of them,
wow.
Obviously in various categories, but half of them. And in 2022, the Butterfly Conservation Trust published a study that revealed a 26% increase in the number of species that are threatened with extinction. And you've got things like the large heath and grayling, both moved from vulnerable to endangered. When the large heath has seen a decrease about 57% in its distribution from 2010 to 2019. So we had 7 species move from near threatened to threatened, including the absolutely stunning swallowtail and Adonis blue. And 2 new species were added to the red list for the first time, being the Scotch Argus, which is listed as vulnerable, and the dark green fritillary, which is now listed as threatened. Now, we haven't done an episode specifically on any butterfly species, but they've popped up in a few.
Yeah.
And a bit like all of the animals we talk about, the largest sort of driver of this change is land use change.
Yeah.
It's loss of nice, diverse fields with wildflowers and rich diversity in the foliage and lots of monoculture, as well as obviously all the pesticides, all the same things you've talked about with the starlings. So I won't go into it too much. But climate change is another one. All 4 British butterflies with northerly distributions and adapted to cooler, damper climates are now listed as threatened. That's the large heath, Scotch Argus, northern brown Argus, which are, they're all listed as threatened. And then the mountain ringlet is the other northerly distributed one that's threatened. So you can see that as the climate's changing, they're losing their cooler,
yeah,
damper habitat. But, and so I won't obviously sit on this one for too long, there are some good news stories as well. So I thought I would just, it was rather concerning that half the species are on the red list. But under some conservation news, the large blue, which became extinct in Great Britain in 1979, has essentially been subject to intensive, ongoing, highly successful reintroduction and has moved from critically endangered to near threatened.
Good
so
news.
That one's gone from extinct and then critically endangered and now up to near threatened. So that one's working its way
back. So it's
back.
Possible, isn't it? It is possible.
Yeah, with some intense some conservation efforts. The high brown fritillary was also listed as critically endangered, has moved up to endangered, which is likely the result of some fantastic work from the Butterfly Conservation Trust and others. And the Duke of Burgundy and Pearl-Bordered Fritillary, which have both gone through quite a lot of targeted conservation programs, have moved from endangered to vulnerable. So we do have some species that are coming back, but they're all ones that have had quite targeted conservation programs. So the efforts have really been, let's get these species back. So it does work, but it's obviously been very deliberate. It's not come about by, a few nice little projects here and there. People are working very, very hard to get these butterfly species back. So we're seeing some decline, but we're seeing some fight back with the help of some fantastic organisations.
Yeah, which is really good news. Have you ever seen a swallowtail?
Yes.
Have you? Because they are absolutely incredible.
They are incredible. I've got a few.
Where did you see one of those?
I can't remember. I've got a few friends who are particularly sort of butterfly chasers, and I was out with them. Might have even been out with Josh. But they are absolutely stunning. I've got very fond memories of chasing butterflies across Heathlands in North Wales.
Yeah.
Pearl-bordered fritillary was one. And every time my friend got down just to take a photo, it flew off. And he spent all day just chasing it around this heath trying to get a photo of it.
Stunningly beautiful,
they
aren't
they? Stunning.
Yeah.
But yeah, there we go. Butterflies. Some bad, some good news, but yeah. A lot on the red list.
Fantastic. Okay, well, I'm on to the little house sparrow.
Oh, I love a house sparrow. Again, you have most of West Sussex house sparrows in your garden.
Casa domesticus, if you want the scientific name. And again, a bit like starlings, their demise is a little bit misunderstood because everywhere you go, you walk down the street, people have got hedgerows. What do you hear? You hear the chattering of house sparrows. So everybody thinks, oh, there's sparrows everywhere. And again, since 1970, 30 million house sparrows have vanished from the UK. Massive decline. And again, I think people find that surprising because if you've done the RSPB Big Garden Bird Watch, which you do every year, you sit in your garden, you count birds, the house sparrow comes top of the most seen bird every year. And it's the one that's declining and is on the red list. So there are a number of reasons that for the decline. They like to nest in holes in buildings and modern houses tend to lack those appropriate cavities, so nesting sites have really are really disappeared. They love a hedgerow, they love shrubby gardens, rough shrubby gardens for cover, and the modern tendency is to tidy up and plastic grass and and to be patios and hard standing and all of that. So a lot of their habitat has completely disappeared from the urban environment. But also, obviously, out in the countryside as well. I used to love diverse crop fields, livestock barns that would be scattered across the landscape full of, spilt seed and grain and all of that. And now clean, intensified monoculture, agriculture has resulted in those barns coming down, less spilled grain, less cover in the fields. This apparently, when I was doing this research, this is prevalent all across the world. This decline in farmland birds has been a result of agricultural change, land use change, agricultural practices completely changing, more monoculture crops, which is not good for biodiversity in any way, never will be. And then we come down to air pollution as well, which is thought to be a problem for sparrows. So in the cities, air pollution has been a problem. They've also suffered a little bit from, which I wasn't aware of actually, there's been a run of avian malaria,
which
I don't know too much about, and I haven't researched it, but that's had a little impact on the house sparrow. So the poor little house sparrow, I'm very happy at the moment because I've got a little gathering that comes in every day, 6 to 8 house sparrows, and that to me is a flock of house sparrows.
Right, would you like to know the collective noun for house sparrows?
Yeah, please, I'd love to.
Apparently it's a host.
A lovely, I like that, host.
Which I thought was quite good. Yeah. Or a quarrel, but a host.
Well, my garden is hosting a little host of house sparrows at the moment, so it's a really lovely thing to see. But they are in trouble. There are some wildlife projects, citizen science surveys, so there's been a lot of surveying because in some parts, they're not quite sure why it's been such dramatic. You can finger point at hedgerows disappearing and habitat loss and nesting sites, but there are other reasons as well. One of the big ones, of course, is the loss over the years of invertebrates. The decline in invertebrates.
It's a big thing for birds in general.
Which is a massive thing. So there's been some Wildlife Trust projects. Wildlife Trust is a brilliant organisation.
Yeah,
so
fantastic.
There's Wildlife Trusts all across the country in different counties, and all of them seem to be doing projects to not only survey the reasons why house sparrows have been declining, but also to try and regenerate the habitat that they prefer. There's been things called Action for Insects, which is trying desperately to plant wildlife meadows on the edge of farmland and trying to engage farmers to do that. And more that is happening.
I mean,
we were talking about that this morning, actually, and that's a good thing.
In previous episodes, we've even spoken about, birds changing their migration route as insect populations change. So it really is a huge thing for them.
In fact,
that's
an episode I like to do because migratory patterns for birds, it's dramatic changes that's been going on over the last decade. And that's actually an episode in its own right because it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's like a weird mix of climate changing the temperature, impacting their breeding seasons and all their food, because insects are coming out later, or insects are changing their movements, and then that has so many downstream impacts for birds. It's
really
interesting.
Yeah, and it's fascinating when you go into that, and of course we're going a little bit off tangent here, off topic here. When you look into that, it's all across the world, countries are saying, oh, we don't see so many of those this year, and that's because they're not travelling so far north, or that bird's not travelling so far south because they're now finding their food source. They don't have to travel so far. So all around the world, those patterns are changing where you see birds and where you don't see birds. And I'm finding that a really fascinating subject.
Yeah, that might have
subject.
To be an episode. Actually.
It
would,
make a really good topic, actually. So,
yeah, so stay tuned for that.
But there are some good projects. One of the ones I really liked is that they were, it was back in 2019 now, but they did a House Sparrows in Schools project supported by an organisation called Restore Our Planet. And the main aims were to raise awareness in schools of the importance of house sparrow populations and make links to the wider issues of decline in countryside birds to involve children in conservation projects. So they were putting little nest boxes up, and they were planting little wildflower meadows in the schools. And I thought that was a great thing, educating and getting youngsters on board to understand that, this common kind of, little brown bird, is really
lovely.
Important. And they were in trouble. So I liked that. So there are various projects going on, ongoing as ever, to try and help the house sparrow, which is in dramatic decline.
Yeah, it's definitely a species that, like I say, people would be, I think, surprised to know they're in decline, because whenever you walk anywhere, really, they're chattering away, and you see them.
The hedgerows are full of them, aren't they?
But actually, it's a bit like the starling murmuration. It sort of gives you a false view of actually what's going on with them.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Well, my next one again is actually quite a quick one with the insects. I haven't got too much to say because we've done a whole episode on this species, I'm pretty sure. And it's the stag beetle. So it really isn't a surprise. It's always been known for being a bit of a rarity, I think. Yeah. Pretty sure we've done an episode on the stag beetle.
Yes, we have.
Yeah, we have, I think quite early on.
Yeah.
So if you really want to dig into stag beetle stuff, then I didn't really want to repeat a whole episode, so go and listen. But I wanted to put this on because it is still listed as near threatened, but it's actually stabilised quite a lot over the last few decades.
Which is great news.
Sadly, not in Europe. In Europe, it's still declining quite rapidly, but in the UK, the population is stabilising, and I say it has stabilised for a while after decades of decline, so it's a really good sign. But I left it on because, A, it's a bit of good news, and it's probably our sort of poster boy for endangered insects, is the stag beetle. We were obviously very lucky in your old house to have a little population
animal
that came out.
Incredible animal.
But they also have some slightly different threats, because obviously land use changes is one of them. But it's actually the loss of dead wood. And again, it's our real habit nowadays to tidy everything up. So when you've got sort of detritus and fallen leaves and rotting wood in parks, not just gardens, but like royal parks and like your local sort of council parks and stuff like that, people go and tidy it all up and make it nice and neat. And really, the beetles want that rotting dead wood, just sort of littered about little log piles and fallen trees and all that sort of stuff. And really, what we need to do when we're looking after our woodlands, parks and gardens is let that go, let it decay, because they become a whole ecosystem for not just beetles. Loads of insects use that log pile and dead wood as their entire lives for some of them. And on a larger scale, you still have things like the woodlands being essentially changed into farmland and built on. And a lot of the woodlands have become forestry plantations where, again, it's like a single species of tree rather than
a
nice diverse primary woodland. So that's another one. So really, it's just a leave nature to do its thing. But they are still sitting on the red list as near threatened. And again, there are loads of fantastic organisations that are working really hard to push the autumnal Leave the Leaves campaigns and things like that. You've got the Woodland Trust out there working really hard with education. I think through a lot of our, certainly through the national parks, you see little green signs normally around piles of wood being like, normally it's a picture of a stag beetle that says, I live here, and it gives you little bits of information about who's living in the log pile.
They've got one at the Wetland Centre. If you walk around the Wetland Centre at Arundel, they've got this huge log pile, and they've actually got this beautiful metal thing that looks like a stag beetle saying, I live here, and then it tells you all about the whole ecosystem that lives in a log pile. They've so it's really fascinating.
It's one of my favourite things. And again, something people can do in their gardens is have a little corner with piles of, I mean, you've got a few piles of
wood. Well, I've put a log pile particularly in the corner. And what I've done as well as the log pile is that I've taken a large log and buried half of it into the ground, because then that helps it to rot down quicker. Yeah. And, you know, I'm stealing your stag beetle thunder here, but stag beetles will lay their larvae into rotting wood. And it's a tough life for the stag beetle, because those larvae will take up to 7 years to actually hatch or whatever they do.
Yeah.
Not hatch, but to mature to enough to come out and as a mature stag beetle. So it's a long maturation, if that's the right word.
Yeah, I mean, it's
not murmuration. Maturation, is that the right word? I think
obviously they pupate, don't they?
It's a long pupation.
It's the same with loads of insects. You know, we talk about like dragonflies and damselflies a lot. They spend most of their life as a larvae in the water, swimming about, and then not very long as an adult dragonfly that we appreciate seeing. And stag beetles are the same. Most of their life is as a big grub in some wood, and the mighty beetle that we absolutely sort of marvel at doesn't have a very long lifespan. They sort of come out, fight, mate, and lay eggs and die. But I was really pleased to read that it stabilized after so many years of decline, and say it's moved up. They were, I think at one point they were critically endangered, and now they're sitting at near threatened. And again, that comes from some fantastic work. There's citizen science projects that have been monitoring them. There was a stag beetle monitoring scheme where if you saw them in your garden, you reported it so they could track where the populations are, and if they're doing well there, then what's the surrounding landscape looking like, and what can we do in other places to try and support them. Again, a lot of it came from education with people who would turf over their garden, take out a really big rotting log or tree stump from their garden, then turf over it, and then the larvae can't dig through all of the netting that you put down or the gravel base and things that people put in their garden. So it was quite a lot of education, I think, about people making sure that if you've got these tree stumps, or if you cut down a tree, maybe leave a little bit of it and all that sort of stuff. But it's great to see that they're doing okay. But they're still sitting, they're still near threatened, but they are improving. What we need now is the same sort of thing to happen over in Europe.
Yeah, well, as ever, you know, lots of people working in the background there trying to save the humble stag beetle.
Yeah, what a mighty looking beetle.
Incredible thing, yeah. So, okay, so I'm on to one that people might go, really? I'm on to the herring gull.
Yeah, again, another. So this is the birds really were what sparked my idea for this topic.
I'm on to the herring gull, the much maligned herring gull, much to my disapproval, I will say, because I think they're absolutely amazing birds. You'd think they were a rapidly increasing pest in our coastal towns and cities, and they're coming more and more inland. But actually, the numbers in the UK and Ireland of the herring gull, I think there's a number of gulls, herring gull being one of the gull family. Seagulls, people call them seagulls. There is no such thing actually officially as a seagull. There's herring gulls and
black-headed gulls and black-backed gulls. Yeah. And
anyway, the herring gull has declined by half to two-thirds since the early 1970s. Same old problems. Decrease in the loss of nesting habitat and lack of food availability.
Despite all the fish and chip shops on the coast.
They're coming inland. They forage in our bins, and there's food that we leave all over the pavements.
I did also in
coastal towns. And
in Clandudno up in North Wales, I had one steal my donut.
Yeah.
I made a real rookie error of opening my box donuts on the beach, and I had to sacrifice them for my life.
I remember us all sitting on Littlehampton seafront with the fish chips out of the paper and them going absolutely mental around us.
I was. I did have to sacrifice those.
They do love a chip, don't they? But again, overfishing, warming seas, decreasing their food quality and quantity. And they're losing nesting sites along the coast again because of changes in environment, and it's a big problem, and it's really sad because they're really smart birds, and they're also really important birds. They're very, very good at cleaning up our beaches, for one. They're really good for that, and they're really, really intelligent. You know, I've got actual a film, little video clip and a photographic reel of them, and I know crows do this as well, of opening mussels on a beach by going up vertically and dropping them onto rocks and opening up muscles. They're a very, very intelligent bird, but they are certainly in trouble.
I think I might have missed it. But did you see what they're categorised as? Is it near threatened? Are they vulnerable?
No, I don't think they're near threatened. I think they're vulnerable.
Okay.
Because they have 72% in 55 years their population has dropped.
Yeah, which again is crazy when you look at... I mean, I guess we're slightly biased living sort of on the south coast.
Yeah.
We see a lot of them.
Absolutely, and people moan about them all the time, particularly if you live slightly, you know, a mile inland from the coastland. The birds are coming inland to feed and to nest on roofs because... their natural nesting roosts along coastline because it's been developed and not.
And they get very protective when they've got a nest with.
They're fantastic parents. Yeah. That's all. They're just being really, really good
parents. And they've
been
forced to come and nest on the roof.
They're amazingly protective of their young, and people think they're just getting gnarly, and actually they're just doing what every parent would do, is protecting their young. But you know, obviously, people perceive them as a pest because they're sitting on their roofs, they're pooing everywhere, and they're attacking people when they've got young. I think on your auntie,
she had some problems with them, didn't she?
She had some problems with them where she couldn't go out the door without putting an umbrella up because a gull would come down and have a go at her because they've got young nearby. So that's why there's this wrong perception of them being
it's a bit like
bad birds, and they're really, really not.
This is a throwback to our last episode where we were talking about good news stories, and I mentioned the really cool solution of using beehives in Africa to stop elephants from getting too close to people. Yeah. And it's one of those examples of, as we disrupt the climate and our population grows and the nature loses their homes, clashes happen because we end up mixing in places that we don't want
to
mix.
And as their food sources, you know, through overfishing, their food sources decline so dramatically in the coast on the coasts around the UK that, you know, they're having to find alternative, and being very resourceful birds, they're finding alternative sources of food, and we're providing a lot of that because we are little outs most of the time, and which is awful, but that's out of necessity.
Obviously, us people sitting watching David Attenborough documentaries, for example, would find it absolutely baffling that anybody could view an elephant as a nuisance. But if they come in and trample across all your farmland stuff, suddenly they are a nuisance. Yeah. And that only happens because we're forcing them, or we're encroaching. And it's exact same with the population of species that we have here. As they lose their homes and we expand into them, animals that perhaps previously you would just think, oh, it's a stunning bird, suddenly becomes a nuisance because they're forced to try and coexist with us and take over our roofs.
But anyway, sadly, I couldn't find any conservation projects.
Oh, maybe we need to start the Herring Gull Conservation Trust.
I couldn't
Trust.
Find any news on how we stop or help the decline of herring gulls. So I've got no good news about the herring gull, apart from that, you know, appreciate them because they're stunningly beautiful birds.
Yeah,
they're very smart.
Need to focus around replenishing our seas. So they've got more
than
natural
food. Yeah,
which
isn't a quick fix, I don't think.
Not an easy thing
at all. Because you've got to somehow reduce fishing quotas and stop.
Yeah, which I mean, I've got fish coming up next, so we can talk about some of our endangered fish.
Yeah, because obviously there's lots of rules and regulations around fishing quotas all around the country. So, that's not an easy fix. So, sadly, I couldn't find any good conservation news about the herring gull, but please view them in a different way if you can, because they're fantastic birds.
They're quite mighty looking birds, I think.
Yeah, they're very smart and very resourceful. Anyway,
right, on to my last invertebrate, moving away from the insects. And I realised we actually haven't done a full episode on this species, but it appeared in our invasive non-native episode, which is actually one of my favourite episodes. So, if you want more information about this species, go and listen to our invasive non-native. I've just used this as quite a lot of reasons to plug our old episodes.
I'm quite liking this episode because we can. I've got a few I can
this
plug later.
This is just clever marketing ploy. but it's the white-clawed crayfish, which is our native crayfish. And again, beautiful, beautiful species. And it's listed as endangered on the red list. And again, it's threatened by things we've spoken about quite a lot whenever we've done a freshwater animal, and it's water quality decline, loss of habitats, things like sort of straightening and artificial modifications to our rivers. And then one of the massive ones, which is why it was in that episode, is the presence of the invasive non-native American signal crayfish, which was brought over essentially for food. And they're very, very prevalent in our rivers. And they not only outcompete our native white-clawed crayfish, but they brought over the crayfish plague, which they're immune to, or lots of them have a an immunity to them, but the white claw doesn't, and it really sort of wiped out a lot of our native species. So they do sit as endangered and are very, they're quite rare. If you see a crayfish in a river, it's typically the American signal one. But there are some fantastic programs breeding them and reintroducing them.
Oh, okay, I like that. You've got some good conservation news.
Yeah, one of them, I don't know whether I mentioned it in the invasive species one or not, but it happened in the River Itchen, which is obviously lovely because it's local to me. And I think it featured on Spring Watch, I think, at some point. And it was sort of a collaboration between a wildlife trust, a rivers trust, and the British Zoological Society, who were the ones who bred them. And then after doing invasive species control and sort of clearing the American signal out of patches of the Itchen, reintroduced a lot of white-clawed crayfish into that river. And they're doing quite well. And then that's being replicated sort of around the country. There are lots of these little collaborations. Normally, wildlife trusts and rivers trusts coming together.
They do so much work, the wildlife trusts.
Yeah, they're brilliant. And reintroducing our native species and trying to control the invasive one. But they really are, I don't know, I would never have expected to call a crayfish beautiful, but they really are stunning invertebrates and really cool to watch them sort of scuttling along the riverbed.
I've never seen one.
I've only seen one white claw. I've seen a lot of American signal crayfish. When I went and did a river cleanup with Action for River Kennet, we walked in the river in big waders and we were clearing litter and stuff, but you'd see these big, big crayfish sort of scuttling underneath, and one of the workers of the trust grabbed one and showed us what they look like, and the American ones are huge, but the white claw is quite a dainty, beautiful thing. But they're really important indicators of good water quality, so you want them in there because it's a good sign that our chalk streams are flourishing, and they're important for the rest of the ecosystem as well. You've got quite a lot of bird species and fish that will sort of eat them, especially when they're little. And then they're just quite useful, like sort of detritivores, and keeping the river functioning nicely. So they're a really important part of our ecosystem, and we really would love to see them come back. And at the moment they are still very much in danger, but there is work trying to re-establish. The problem is the American crayfish is incredibly hard to get rid of, to the point where the advice used to be if you came across one you should kill it, not meant to be in the river. However, there's been studies that show that if you start killing too many of them and leave a population, the drop in population triggers them to breed more vigorously because they're like, our numbers are low, replenish. So if you just kill one or two, you might then trigger loads more. Wow. So they're really hard to get rid of. So
that's
advice,
a real balancing act, isn't
it? The advice is actually, I think, and I don't take my word on this, I think it became like, unless you're out there doing like a proper targeted clearance and you catch one, put it back, because you're at risk of them promoting them from start breeding more vigorously.
Not an easy task, is it?
Yeah, so the white claw is battling quite a few things. The invasive species are very hard to get rid of, and the illness that they brought over really did do quite a number on our native populations. But that might not be surprising in the sense that it's a well-known species that's struggling. But I don't think people necessarily know we've got an endangered native crayfish that really needs our help. But thankfully there are some fantastic programs.
So the wildlife trusts are doing really well.
Yeah, wildlife trusts and some local rivers trusts and some zoological societies as well.
Do you know what I've got to say to them?
Well, there's a soundboard. Right, that's enough of that.
I had to throw one in.
But yeah, I think that brings me to the end of my invertebrate section.
Tell you what, you know, we said this might be a shorter episode. We've got quite a lot to do.
Yeah, to be fair, I can clump my fish into one big category.
Clump them into a shoal.
I can clump it into two instead of like eight, so it's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to just do one more bird. I could do more.
Oh, we've got more birds. I thought we were moving.
Well,
on
I was going to do, the greenfinch, but I wanted to do the puffin.
Oh,
and
the puffin.
I'll tell you why I wanted to do the puffin is because it's one of the it is one of the most loved and popular birds in the world.
Yeah, I mean, people flock to puffin islands.
Yeah,
don't they?
Absolutely. And I think again, there is that perception. Every time you see a puffin on a bit of wildlife film or anything, you'll see vast colonies of them, you know, on the cliffs that have come in to breed. They're actually obviously a migratory bird here. They spend most of their time actually at sea until they come in to land, obviously, for breeding. I think when they come to the UK for breeding, I think we host about 10% of the puffin population once they're here. But they have now, they're the UK's highest priority conservation species.
Oh, really?
As they've recently joined the European Red List as vulnerable to global extinction. So I wanted to mention the puffins. We've talked about, I think we talked about in an episode, declining sand eels.
Yeah.
I can't remember where we were discussing that, but one of their main food sources is sand eels. So the biggest problem they have is a decline in food. And again, predation when they are on land. There's been a lot of rat populations growing on the islands and the places that they come into to breed. So predation has been a huge problem. So invasive rats preying on their eggs and chicks is an increasingly frequent problem. And violent storms. We've had a huge amount
of storms,
haven't we?
I think
through December, they said in December alone we'd had 10 storms.
The last few years, we've had so many named storms, ones that have been severe enough to be sort of given their own name. And I swear we've had more in the last few years than we have in most of my life.
So violent storms, oil spills, the emerging threat of bird flu has had an impact, and we know that we've had avian flu.
Hit a lot of seabirds.
Lot of seabirds in this country over the last 4 or 5 years. In fact, it's been pretty awful, to be honest. So that's been a problem, and they reckon if it continues at the rate of decline, that they think that it could be up to 90% by 2050, and then close to extinction from there on. Again, I couldn't find a lot of good news about puffin conservation. It's just trying to stop the overfishing and eradicate the population of predators such as rats that have grown. I've seen that happen. I've seen and read quite a lot of RSPB reports about where they've gone onto islands where seabirds are nesting, and they've had to eradicate predation like that. They've had to get rid of all the rats. That's a big thing. But I love puffins.
Yeah, they are stunning.
They're the most charismatic and fun things to watch and photograph and see. So I only wanted to highlight them because they are actually,
struggling.
I say, the highest priority conservation species now of birds. So
right, well, in
so
the,
that's me done with the birds.
In the interest of it not being a four-hour episode, what I'm going to do is clump mine into freshwater and marine, because for freshwater, to be fair, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 species, but they're all threatened pretty much from the same thing. So a bit like I did with butterflies, and whack them into freshwater fish. Now, the first one gives me a lovely excuse for another self-promotion plug, because it's the European eel. And I still maintain it's one of my favourite episodes we ever did, because I learned so much about eels.
Yeah.
Like the fact that they were so abundant at one point, they were a currency, which is just
which was bonkers,
mental.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
And they are now one of our most endangered species. And so the species I've got is European eel, Atlantic salmon, Alice shad, if that's how you say it, European whitefish, and twait shad. Is it twait or twite?
I don't know.
T-W-A-I-T-E. I'm not a fisherman, so I'm going to say twait.
Not
but
something I'm even aware of, actually.
But the eel is listed as critically endangered. Atlantic salmon are endangered but declining. The Alice shad is critically endangered. European whitefish is endangered. And the twite shad is vulnerable. And reason why they can sort of justifiably be clumped together is they're all suffering from decline in water quality. So obviously it's something very close to my heart, but it's, you know, things like sewage, chemicals, nutrient runoff, plastics, all the various types of pollution that our rivers and sort of lakes and everything are suffering from. Another huge one, especially for things like the Atlantic salmon and European eel, but quite a lot of the others too, is barriers to their migration. They're both really migratory species, and we've got all sorts of things in our rivers, got dams and weirs and artificial changes that essentially make it really difficult for them to move up and down the rivers, get out to sea, for example. And so that's a hugely problematic thing for their spawning and breeding, which obviously then impacts their numbers in very obvious ways, as well as the more direct overfishing and exploitation, which was obviously a huge driver for the eels when they were so abundant and big food source, and then very much got decimated. A new one that I learned about eels very recently is we apparently export millions to Russia.
Do we? I didn't know that. Did that come up in our episode?
No, I only found out because I shared for the River Trust, I shared this story, but we export loads of young eels to Russia. And
that's not good.
No, apparently the people who sort of say it's a good thing. People who are involved in this exportation say that because essentially the eels go out to the Sargasso Sea, which is where they mate and then breed.
On
and
that
then,
amazing migration.
Yeah, which
that
people
they do.
Still don't really understand. Yeah. And then they come back to our rivers to sort of mature. The apparently, like, it's easier for them to migrate from Russia and get to the sea. However, the fisheries director from whichever city it was in Russia actually came out and stated they're more likely to be caught and eaten before they ever get out to sea to breed. So that's not, it's not a conservation effort. It's a money thing. But I had no idea. But we export millions of eels over to Russia. So that's another problem, which is baffling when they're already one of our most endangered species. So declining water quality, barriers and overfishing. I also just threw in one extra species called the Vendace, which I again
never
heard of. Which is why I threw it in there. It's an enigmatic species of fish. Few people are aware of its existence. And in the UK, it's an Ice Age relic, survives in only two natural sites, both in the Lake District.
Wow.
Apparently it has increased slightly at these sites, but they are threatened by all the same things as rivers. The lakes are struggling with nutrient runoff and pollution problems and things like that. There was a population in Scotland, but they're now both extinct. And so there's two populations in the Lake District, and that is it. They're one of our most sort of threatened and rarest fish. And I just thought I'd throw them in there.
I'm going to have
really
to go and look that up because I don't even know what it looks like. So
no,
I'm
they're,
go on
they're
and
really
have to
cool.
Find out about that.
But then, a bit like we've mentioned in a few episodes, there are lots of fantastic projects, a great opportunity for me to plug Rivers Trust. But
hang on, you're plugging the Rivers Trust?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit of a cliche though at this point, but you can pipe down with your soundboard over there. I'm going to have to get one of my own. But there are loads of them who are working really hard to obviously combat things like pollution chemicals, but the other big one is removing dams and weirs or installing things like fish passes and making sure that these species can do their migratory routes and get to the breeding grounds and just actually move up and down our rivers. So there's lots of work being done for all of these species. The Atlantic salmon and European eel are two that are real focus species for loads of organisations because they're, again, big indicators that our rivers are doing well. And we've lost a lot of them. So there's a lot of work to try and bring them back. But there's actually a really cool collaborative organisation called the Missing Salmon Alliance, which is lots of different organisations like the Rivers Trust, the Angling Trust, who are all working together for the sole purpose of Atlantic salmon conservation, both in the rivers and out to sea and things like that. So, but again, it's difficult to combat things like overfishing and stuff like that, and obviously pollution. But there's a lot of work being done to try and help them. So there we go. I've knocked out all my freshwater fish in one big hit.
You've done a good job there. So I'm gonna steam on to mammals because my little next category is mammals. I think I mentioned earlier that the British Mammals Red List has now been authorised by IUCN, and the first approved red list for Britain's mammals was published in 2020. Wasn't a good find, actually. Found that one in four British mammals are now at risk of extinction. So that wasn't a good report to read. And I'm going to talk about one that I'm sure people aren't surprised by, and that's the hedgehog. We've done an episode about hedgehogs.
Yeah, help the hedgehog.
Help the hedgehog.
Basically, what we're saying is just go and listen to all of our episodes.
But they're now listed as near threatened on the red list, which is very concerning. And particularly in urban areas, they're being pushed towards extinction in urban areas. Obviously, urban development, fragmented habitats fragmented by roads and infrastructure that has completely fragmented
and habitat. I mean it ties into your birds, loss of hedgerows,
definitely, and we've talked about that before where habitats have been fragmented, breeding then declines, and they've got nowhere to go. They just end up in these little pockets of habitat.
Also ties in nicely because again lack of insects and grubs, they eat
gradually
a lot of
their food source declines, numbers decline, but numbers have decreased by 46% in the last 13 years. However, I have got some good news about that. There's a great organisation called People's Trust for Endangered Species, or PTES, if you want the acronym for that. And they're working really hard to restore rural environments. And they're doing a huge amount of work coordinating hedgehog conservation across the UK. In fact, we'll put a link onto that website because they're actually asking people to fight to save the nation's favourite mammal. Because it is in real,
I love a hedgehog.
Real problems. And you can go onto their site and you can help, but in various ways, not just donating money, ways that we talked about in the episode of even changing your garden to be more hedgehog friendly, leaving walkways through your fences so that because they travel across a habitat and they need to be able to do that. So there are lots of ways that we can help the hedgehog. I would definitely recommend people to go onto this website and see how they can help. But they're in real problems. Yeah, the decline in insects is a huge one. Pesticides.
Pesticides
that we're using in our gardens. You know, I've completely stopped using any chemicals in my garden at all. And sometimes, you know, my plants get eaten and I really don't care anymore because pesticides and chemicals in the garden are not good for birds, they're not good for insects. And that whole ecosystem in your urban garden changes dramatically. So I urge people to stop as much as they can using any kind of chemicals in their garden. Go on to our rewilding.
That was our very first episode.
To find out
I reckon
more.
The sound quality would be quite different, and probably us.
Well, right? I hope it will be. But, yeah. So anyway, yeah, the humble hedgehog.
Right, well, then I will go on to my marine. I actually only have two species for marine, but again, I can knock them both out in one hit.
Okay.
One is the spiny dogfish, which they're sort of like, they're cartilaginous fish. They're sort of like little sharks, and they're really cool. And they're often the ones that leave those mermaid purses on the beach.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought, people see mermaid purses quite a lot. Maybe they think there's a lot of spiny dogfish out there. And they were sort of once quite abundant, but they are now actually classified as critically endangered in the northeast Atlantic, which is a bit concerning, meaning stocks around Europe particularly have decreased by at least 95%. The reason why I thought I'd throw this one in there is that I didn't realise for a while chip shops were selling them under sort of various generic names when they were caught as bycatch. So if they were it was allowed for them to sell them in chip shops, but they'd be called things like Huss, Rock, Flake and Rock Salmon. Actually, when DNA barcoded, it turned out to be spiny dogfish.
I never knew that.
So, and they are a shark species classified as endangered in Europe and now they're critically endangered in certain regions. And so people were eating them and unaware that they were eating them because this law that said if it's bycatch, you can sell them anywhere. And then they just put them as a generic name so people don't think they're eating essentially a species of shark. And it had a real impact on their population because, people can say it's bycatch, but then how is it, though? If all the other fish stocks are depleting, then why wouldn't you grab an abundant species and sort of bulk out your catch with it? So that was an interesting thing because it was a DNA barcoding study that revealed what was actually being sold in these chip shops to be spiny dogfish.
Wow.
I sadly don't have any good news for them. The other one is the thornback ray, which is actually our most commonly encountered ray species, but it's on the red list as near threatened and declining quite rapidly. Primarily, it's overfishing that's impacted the rays, but they, like a lot of sort of shark and cartilaginous-y fish, have traits that make them really vulnerable to overfishing because they have quite a slow growth, they mature sexually quite late, and they don't have that many young in one go, which means that if their population takes a hit at any one time, it takes a long time for them to try and recover. And so since they've been fished quite heavily, they're basically declining quite rapidly. There have been a few conservation measures put in place to try and help our thornback ray. In 2008, the European Union essentially introduced a regulation requiring commercial trawlers to differentiate between ray species so you can just whack it all under ray's court and then essentially change that gave them a more accurate sort of assessment of our populations, and then they could change the aim for management, you know, giving them numbers that they couldn't exceed and things like that to try and make sure that individual species were actually being looked after. You couldn't just lump it under one title. However, and that it has helped, but they are quite vulnerable, and continued monitoring and, again, implementing effective management of fisheries is very difficult because it's hard to keep an eye on what's going on out there.
We've talked about that in the past.
Yeah,
as well,
but quite a lot is going to need to be done to make sure that they survive long term. The same, and I haven't got a lot of information, but the same is for the undulate ray, which is a bit rarer anyway. And there's been declines of or reduction of 80% in some regions since the 1980s. So they're dropping rapidly, and this is all due to overfishing and not sort of monitoring them properly. They just sort of get stuck in a category, raise caught, and people aren't realizing we're losing multiple species in one go just by not really differentiating between them properly and not keeping an eye on it. Again, undulate ray, there's actually a project called the Undulate Ray Project, which is just for the monitoring and study of these species to try and create a strategy that will actually work. But currently, it's still very vulnerable, and they're a hard thing to monitor. So yeah. Both of our, I think we've got more than two, actually, but those two ray species yeah. in particular are struggling.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to skip on a little bit. I can't do a thing on mammals without mentioning the water vole. We did a whole episode on the water vole, so probably best if you go and listen to that. But I couldn't ignore it because it is still our fastest declining mammal. Populations have plummeted by 97% since the 1970s. And again, I won't go too far into it because we've done an episode, but again, that PTES have done 46 water vole projects around the country. We've investigated what helps water voles to seek refuge from the American mink because the introduction yeah. of the American mink decimated the population of the water vole, which again, hey, you'd
guess
find
what?
Out.
Guess what? Eden Rivers Trust did a fantastic water vole reintroduction, so I'll throw another Rivers Trust plug in there.
I think you should. And but there are lots of reintroduction projects and habitat restoration going on all around the UK. And initial signs from the monitoring programs that have been going on is that there is real signs for hope. There's still a huge amount of work to be done. It's very hard, again, which we've touched on before, to eradicate an invasive species that's non-native. Once it's been established, it's very hard. You talked about the crayfish.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a very similar
grey
thing.
Grey squirrels.
Well, I was going to go on to grey squirrels. In fact, I'm going to go on to that now because my next one I was going to throw in was a red squirrel. I don't think people would be surprised by that. A lot of people haven't even seen a red squirrel in the UK. There are various parts of the country, lots up in Scotland, Northumberland,
North Wales,
Northern Ireland, Lake District, Brownsea Island, places like that. But, you know, back in 1800s, there were 3.5 million of them in this country. There's now less than 120,000 in the UK, and the population in England is thought to be as low as 15,000. Grey squirrels have pretty much decimated it. But again, lots and lots of great conservation projects going on to create the habitat that they thrive in to try and relocate grey squirrels away from those red squirrel strongholds. So lots of things going on in the background. So there's some good news, but not great news. That's after. So I've just done red squirrels and water voles. That's pretty much me for the mammals, actually.
Okay, well, I mean, we can knock out reptiles and amphibians pretty quickly.
I've only got one on the amphibians, actually.
Well, I'll say what I was going to...
Because, again, one we've done is Natterjack
yeah.
Toad. So
maybe
we've done
we should have titled this episode,
that.
Go listen to our previous
episodes.
We probably
episodes. Could have just listened to episode 24 yeah. and 36.
But
and
on that, what I thought was interesting and what I've realised more so, you know, sort of doing this episode and recording it, is that each time we normally focus on a single species. I know we do habitat episodes as well, but you know this is very much highlighted. We've got an eel species, got a water vole species, got a stag beetle episode, yeah. a sort of species episode yeah. rather. So we pick one that's struggling and we talk about it. And if you listen to all of them, you'll find the links. But when you whack them all in one go and actually look at something like the red list, where you can see them moving, oh, they were least vulnerable, now they're vulnerable, now they're endangered. In this region, they're critically endangered, and you can see it going down. When you go through the list, You take the fish or all the freshwater animals, pollution, barriers, overfishing, that's impacting loads. Look at how many species we now have on the red list.
Yeah.
Look at our butterflies and birds. We've got land use change, chemical pesticides, monoculture, habitat fragmentation. We've got half our butterfly species, loads of birds that you wouldn't expect. You take our mammals, you've got invasive species impacting water voles and grey squirrels, now both on the red list. So if you put them all together in one episode or one thing and look at how many of our native species are either just reaching the red list or getting worse on the red list, all because of these same issues, it highlights sort of the real...
Gives a real big picture, doesn't it?
Yeah, big picture impact of these issues. You can look, oh no, our water vole's declining. but also actually look at all of our other mammals declining as well. And it sort of really highlights the scale of these problems and the wide-ranging impact.
It's actually quite a sad overview,
isn't it?
It is,
and I think, you know, we're coming off the bat of our previous episode being a whole positive look at all the great stuff that went on in 2024. So in the light of us promoting our previous episode, you want a bit of a pickup after this slightly sadder episode. Our last one was all positive, but it does show that these issues that we talk about each species, actually the big picture is across all taxonomic groups, our native species are really struggling.
I think you still can take positives from this episode by the fact that we've highlighted the conservation efforts as well, and there are always conservation efforts going on. I know I couldn't find any for the herring gull and puffins and a few that I couldn't find conservation efters being mounted for those.
But they might not be targeted. There might be habitat ones that will benefit.
And it might be, you know, campaigning for less fishing in an area or whatever it may be. But I still maintain always, always behind the scenes, there are incredible organisations and people and citizen science and campaigners and people like Chris Packham and people like that are fighting so hard to try and save all of these red-listed and species and habitats that we've been talking about and continue to talk about and will always be talking about about that.
Highlighted a few really, really targeted, successful things for certain butterfly species, and it works when these people are working.
But that's the thing, it does work.
And by improving the populations of those butterflies, it's a little bit sad, but it's a circle of life. The caterpillars will then feed the birds, and then those bird populations improve as well. So it is all linked. And where that is sad, being that our insects decline, which means everything declines, if you start saving the habitats and insects, everything else does better as well.
Well, we were talking this morning, not on this recording, but we were talking this morning about how encouraging it is that the farmers and the landowners are getting on board with leaving, you know, the edges of their farmland for wildflower meadows,
wetlands,
and letting the wet areas of the fields without draining them. So they are coming on board. It's a slow burn, but it is moving. It is changing, and we have to be positive. You have to stay positive.
Yeah, otherwise, you know, you stop.
So we don't want this to be an all doom.
No, we realise that, you know, we're saying look at how many species are struggling, but also look at the fact that it does work in some places and there are people doing it. But I think it is useful sometimes to zoom out and just look at it as a big picture rather than we're always very zoomed in on a single species. And actually, it's, whilst maybe not positive, it is, I think, valuable to look at the decline of our species as a whole in the UK and what we need to keep on doing.
I'm not going to mention that sentence that Angela Rayner said. I am going to mention that sentence that Angela Rayner said. Protecting wildlife shouldn't come at the expense of building more homes. That's all I've got to say to you, Angela Rayner. That's enough.
So very quickly then.
I love my sound effects.
I'm definitely going to have to take that off you. I may have to swap seats. Reptiles and amphibians were tricky because A, we don't have that many species here, and B, none of them are particularly surprising. So I've thrown sand lizard, smooth snake and adder. Sand lizard's endangered, smooth snake is vulnerable and adder is vulnerable, and near threatened in Great Britain, Scotland is vulnerable in England. And again, I'm not going to go too much into them because we've sort of just done almost like a wrap-up in between, but it's the same sort of things. It's habitat degradation, fragmentation, changes in land use and habitat management, but there are loads of brilliant efforts to conserve them. Again, go listen to our fantastic episode. We've done an adder episode and we've done one with Ruben Martin. So if you want to go listen to about adders, we've got loads of cool
information. One of my favourite episodes, I will hasten to add.
And again, Ruben's a fantastic example of somebody young working very hard to conserve our reptiles. So,
and that gives you hope, doesn't it?
So if you want a bit of hope...
All the time there's Rubens in this world, there's hope.
Yeah, so there's always people working hard. But it's safe to say, you know, some of our native reptiles are struggling for all the same reasons that our other species are. But they are indeed on the
list. I'm going to give you a little quiz question.
Oh, God.
Do you know what the scientific name of a common toad is?
Yes, it's Bufo Bufo.
I knew you'd know that. Yes.
I always hesitate because Bubo Bubo is the European eagle owl. Yes. I think.
Butio is a buzzard, I think.
Yeah, I think I might have got that eagle owl one wrong. But yeah, Bufo, I always, because I think it's just such a cracking name.
I had
name.
A feeling that you'd know that. So.
That's good. My zoology degree was worth the debt.
So that's my last, my only amphibian, the common toad, on the brink of qualifying for protection as vulnerable species, gone on the red list. It's fallen by more than two thirds since the 1980s. Urban sprawl, habitat fragmentation, loss of breeding ponds, drainage of wet areas, reduced amount of wet woodland, human infrastructure like roads has threatened. The common toad now is on the red list and near threatened species across Great Britain, England and Scotland.
And I'll just hop in and say, hop. Actually, toads walk, but it's not the point. If you want to help toads, get involved in toad patrols because they're fantastic. Yeah.
So again, lots of conservation efforts. Yeah. You go on the AMRC.
The Amphibian Reptile Conservation Trust.
That's the one. You go on their website, lots and lots of conservation efforts for amphibians and reptiles. Again, check out Ruben. He'll tell you all about the things that are being done,
It may not sound fun, but I can personally vouch to say spending an evening in a high-vis stopping cars so that toads can cross the road is a great way
That's
to spend some time.
That's a fantastic way of spending your time.
And just to backtrack,
we should all be doing that.
I did get the European Eagle Owl name right, so...
Yeah.
The degree was definitely worth
it. I think we may be done. There is hope. There's always hope.
We promise.
I've enjoyed playing with my with my buttons on here as much as Matthew's enjoyed listening to them. But we just wanted to highlight a few, particularly with the birds that people didn't maybe think were threatened and the reasons why. So we hope you've enjoyed this episode. We will be back for... maybe a more uplifting one.
Yeah,
I quite like one about citizen science. I'd quite
like
to
that would be cool. And like I say, if you really want a bit of positivity, we did an hour long episode of all the good stuff.
Because there's some really positive, good news stories around the world that went on in 2024. We're hoping that at the end of this year we'll be doing a similar one, and there'll be more good news stories.
We'll always focus on the positive. But the last thing I'll say is just to reiterate the point that we went sort of we did the wrap up before reptiles and amphibians. That I think sometimes a zoomed out big picture view sort of just highlights what needs to be done.
It gives you a big picture, doesn't it?
Rather than always focusing on individual species. But that was a little whistle stop tour. Well, I say whistle stops, probably at least over an hour tour of some of our red listed species.
We could have talked about a lot more, actually.
Yeah.
But sadly...
And, if you want more, clearly we've got plenty of episodes out there already. Yeah. I might put that as the episode description. Just go listen to our old episodes.
Just go listen to all 45 episodes.
But hopefully you've enjoyed it. I hope you've learned something, if nothing else, the fact that starlings have a great name of a chattering.
Yeah, and we'll put some links in for you to follow and good stuff to look at.
Oh, hang on, influencer stuff. Go follow us on Instagram at TheBirdieBugPod. We will be getting some content out. It's been a very busy 2024 and a very ill start to 2025.
Not a good healthy start.
But we will be putting some content out, so please do go follow us.
I'm sure I sounded a little bit more nasally than normal, but I've resisted the cough.
You
so
survived.
Survived.
So thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Bye.